Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm not here.
You are not. That's right. Figment of my imagination.
I am indeed. Close your eyes.
Yeah.
There you go. I'm actually in Sacramento at NABS, and I'm having a great time, I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure you are as well.
And you're probably really out riding your bike and training for Calvin's.
We can hope.
One can only hope.
All right.
But
nonetheless, we have a show.
We do have a show,
It's
going to be an awesome show. Awesome. In fact, I am very honored because a few months ago, you might remember, I said we saw the movie The Flying Scotsman.
Yes.
And I said, he's my new hero, Mr. Graham O'Bree.
Mm-hmm.
I tracked him down.
Good.
And he is on the show tonight.
All right.
By virtue of another really interesting technological marvel named Skype.
Uh-huh.
So I actually got to see him when I did this interview, and it was really fun. He had his son in the room with him, and his son was sitting next to him just cracking up during the whole interview. It was really, really cool. Graham is a very interesting guy. He broke the world one-hour record twice.
Mm-hmm.
He was a world champion. He's recently written a practical and really informative training manual titled The O'Bree Way, and he is a stitch. So he's on the show. And then I have another interesting guest named Tom Bowden. Now you're going to say, all right, who's Tom Bowden? Well, he lives and works in Richmond, Virginia. He's an attorney. He did compete and finish RAM. He's a very good writer, although he would beg to differ. But I like his writing. I think it's interesting. He did an op-ed piece in the Washington Post not too long ago about cycling and Representative Eric Cantor. It was a very interesting piece.
Yeah.
Needing more to do, of course. He's also the chairman of Bike Virginia and is heading up the committee that is bringing the 2015 World Road Cycling Championships to his town. How cool is that?
Yeah.
So, you see, we really do have a good show this evening.
All right. Let's get started.
All right. Let's welcome Tom Bowden to The Outspoken Cyclist. Tom, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
I'd like to begin with your journey from hardcore RAM rider to the, and this is your, these are your words, tweety laid-back commuter that you are today. Can you give us some background on you and your bicycling history? Like, who are you?
Well, okay. I'd start earlier than that and say I've always liked bikes from the time I was 4 years old, I guess. But to fast forward to 1994, a neighborhood friend of mine who would we'd go out on bike rides occasionally, a little longer than average, but not terribly long. On one of our rides, just casually said, "I read about this new thing. They have Race Across America for teams, for relay teams. You want to do it?" And I said, "Sure, why not?" And from there, everything followed. And for about a year and a half, we trained really hard. We hired a coach. We got really fancy bikes and recruited some more team members, one more from the neighborhood, and then one younger guy that was referred to us who turned out to be the strongest guy on the team. And put together all the logistics and did the thing. It was a great experience.
Which RAM was that? Was that 95?
This was 1994.
Oh, did it in 94.
Yeah, so that's coming up on 20 years. So it's part of my distant past.
So, do you remember how horrible it was?
Well, you know, there were horrible moments,
and
I remember those. But I remember the scenery. I remember just the sense of the vastness of the country. I mean, Oklahoma is a lot longer than it really needs to be, and the wind is always in your face, and it's there are other things. The heat was at times was just amazing. I wouldn't say it was oppressive because, you know, as they say, it was a dry heat, but it was a little bit daunting at times. And then when you got up into the high elevations, it was downright chilly. So it was quite an experience, and glad to say I did it. Don't have a crushing, burning desire to do it again, but it was a lot of fun, and hardly a day goes by I don't think about it.
Interesting. You know, we've been involved here with the show with a lot of Ram riders. There are quite a few from Ohio. I don't know. Maybe Ohio spawns Presidents and Race Across America riders, evidently.
Could be.
Yeah.
You've got to be a little crazy to do either one.
Exactly. Exactly. And I know that strange things can happen on Ram. We also just screened Bicycle Dreams here a couple weeks ago.
Yes. I just recently got a copy of that. That's just a fascinating movie, and of course, you know, not going to reveal everything if others haven't seen it, but it really gets into the agony and the ecstasy, so to speak.
Yeah. Did you race other than that? Did you do any other kind of racing?
I did some racing. I used to like to do time trials, and time trials of anywhere from 10 to 25 miles, but usually on the shorter end of things, sprints, and was happy doing that. Didn't particularly care to race in a pack, with a day job. Didn't really want to break my collarbone or my leg or do any of the things that are fairly common in criterium racing, which was mostly what was around. So I mostly did time trials, but I would occasionally get into a criterium or a road race, and I found that my time trial mentality was not a good fit. If you are clinging to the back of somebody's wheel in a criterium and you start to fall back an inch and then two and then four, eight, before you know it, you're a foot off the wheel and then all of a sudden you're off the back. And in a time trial, you set your own pace, but in a criterium, someone else is setting the pace. And I guess there's something about my mentality. I don't like someone else setting the pace, especially if it's faster than I want to go.
Have you always lived in Virginia?
No, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I moved to Virginia, among other reasons, because I saw a great opportunity for cycling. My wife is from Virginia. She grew up here, and after we were married, we spent a lot of time visiting her folks here in Virginia, and I spent a good bit of time riding out in the countryside west of Richmond, and then started to think, well, what is it in my DNA that says because I was born in Pennsylvania, I have to stay there? And I got the answer that there's no reason on earth why you should stay someplace just because you were born there. And so I decided to look around for a job in Richmond and found one, moved down. And in between starting the search and actually getting here, we had three children in the space of 18 months. And so
We must have had twins in there somewhere.
Yes, we had twins. Our son was born in 1988, and the girls were born in 1990, 18 months later, almost to the day.
Are they identical twins?
No, they're not.
Ah,
no,
okay.
They're equally beautiful and intelligent, and they're best of friends, but they're not identical.
So you went from doing Ram, and then you did a little bit of time trialing, mm-hmm. and now you actually are the tweety, laid-back bike commuter. When did you start commuting? Because that's going to lead us into really what this is all about.
Yeah, well, I started commuting about 4 years ago. And
okay.
I think, as did a lot of people, when gas really hit $4 and we said, this is just absurd. And I was fortunate to have a commuting route available to me that took me along the James River for 2 or 3 miles, past some beautiful rapids and rock falls, and then through nice neighborhoods. And I sent you an article that I wrote that describes cycling in Richmond, and there are just wonderful roads to ride on. Not all of them are great, but if you think about it and plan your route, you can get from almost any place to any place else in Richmond and have a nice, safe, placid commute. It's only when you try to ride with the cars and compete with them on their main arterials that you can maybe run into a problem. So I started riding, just because it seemed like a good thing to do with gas prices that high, and I wanted to have a little exercise. I hadn't ridden a lot for a number of years, so it got me back into the activity. And then once I started doing it, I said, well, I like this. I'm going to just keep on doing it.
And how far was the commute? Is the commute?
About 15 miles
each
way.
So you get 30 miles in every day.
Right, but I don't live that far away anymore.
Oh, so you move closer to work.
Right.
Ah.
But sometimes I take a longer route just to get a few miles in,
sure.
Or I do errands on my bike. I didn't do that so much. Now I do it more.
Well, okay, so you are an attorney.
Yes.
A practicing attorney.
Mm-hmm.
You're a writer.
Well,
you are
I
a writer.
Write things. I strive, I aspire to be a writer.
Well, you can't deny it because I've seen your published works.
Well, thank you.
Okay. You are also the chairman of Bike Virginia and a member of the board of Virginia Bicycling Federation. What's happening with Bike Virginia? First of all, is Bike Virginia the organization that puts on cycle?
Bike Virginia? It is.
Okay.
We have recently changed our name from Bike Walk Virginia to Bike Virginia.
Okay.
And that reflects a decision to focus on cycling. And it's not that we're certainly not anti-pedestrian by any stretch, but just with limited resources and limited staff and plenty of obstacles and challenges to overcome for cyclists, we thought that it would be best to devote our resources to something that would be more focused. And it happened that at the time, most of the board were predominantly cyclists and certainly enjoy the outdoors and hiking and walking and all that, but they saw their mission more oriented towards cycling. So we decided to change the mission statement and change the name and focus on that. So now Bike Virginia, the event, is the Bike Virginia Tour, and Bike Virginia is the organization.
And so that tour, it's a week-long tour?
I think it's 5 days.
Okay, and is it across the state?
And it moves around the state.
Okay.
So it's centered, it's usually like a star. You have a base of operations. Maybe sometimes you move from one city to another, but, out and back rides so that you can set up a tent city and have all the logistics centralized.
Are you doing advocacy from out of Bike Virginia, too?
Yes, but to a degree. I do that just as a personal activity as much as anything. I started when I joined Bike Virginia, when I joined the board, I became chair of the advocacy committee, but these days we don't so much have a separate committee. We're all working on things. The staff, the paid staff, mostly works on the events, but also gets involved in advocacy issues, and then the board members cooperate with one another to work on different causes. And this is the General Assembly time in Richmond, as it is in many states. So we're tracking legislation and watching it. And some of us have had the opportunity to go up and meet with legislators and try to make a point.
So that brings us to your Washington Post op-ed.
Yes.
You wrote one called "Welcome to the Bike Path, Mr. Cantor."
Yes.
And you make no bones about being conservative and about sort of being a pro-Eric Cantor guy.
Well, I know the man, and he's a good man. I know a lot of people disagree with many of his positions, and I've stated quite openly that I don't agree with all of his positions. I don't think that should be the test of your support for any candidate, and I don't think that any candidate can ever, or any elected representative can ever have a set of positions that everyone will agree with. It's ridiculous. But he is a powerful man with power in funding these kinds of things, and he's influential, and I think he's on the wrong side of the transportation policy debate and haven't been shy about saying so, both in the paper most recently in that article, but have written to him over the years and met with him and met with his staff in Washington in connection with the Bike Summit, and then again in his local office. And I don't know whether we'll ever change his mind on that, but we're certainly not going to give up trying. And my reason for writing the article was that as stated in the article, the D.C. Streets blog sort of went after Mr. Cantor because of his position on the transportation bill and decided that he was being a hypocrite for being shown riding a bike in a 60 Minutes episode. And, I just said, give the guy a break. He's riding a bike, and maybe that's an olive branch. Maybe it's intended to distract us. Who knows what it is, but I'll take it at face value. Here's Eric Cantor on a bike. Well, good. That's a good thing. I'd like to see John Boehner on a bike. I'd like to see Nancy Pelosi on a bike.
Yep.
Let's get them all on bikes, and then maybe we can have a rational discussion.
Hey, the Secretary of Transportation rides a bike.
Well, sure he does. Yeah, he's a big supporter. And, my point in all of my advocacy writings tends to come back to the idea that let's take the partisanship out of it. There are Republicans who are very pro-bike. There are Democrats who are anti-bike. And it's not a liberal-conservative thing. Right now, it seems that the issues are framed along party lines. That's true, but it doesn't have to be that way. It hasn't always been that way, and there's certainly nothing inherent in the philosophy of conservatism that is anti-bike any more than there is in the philosophy of liberalism that it should be pro-bike. Bikes are good.
I agree. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Tom Bowden. He's at home in Richmond, Virginia, and he is an attorney, a bike advocate, a commuter, and a writer, whether he thinks so or not, and a past Ram rider, which, of course, that always elevates people in my eyes that somebody would actually take their bike and race across America. So let's move on to the Worlds in 2015. How are you involved in that?
Well, I'm very fortunate to be involved at a professional level because I am the counsel to the nonprofit organization Richmond 2015, Inc., that is the organizing committee, the organizing body for the race. And Richmond 2015 is the same organization but renamed that organized a pro race for about 4 years in Richmond that was known as the CapTech Classic. And so when the 2015 bid was something that we undertook, we renamed it and to a more appropriate name, Richmond 2015, Inc. And now we have a board of about 17 or 18, and we're trying to expand that board with both national, regional, government, business, and we'll probably get to about 50 or 60 board members at large, and then we'll have an executive committee of a smaller group that'll be more actively involved, and we'll be looking for national support because we see Richmond 2015, although it will be in Richmond, and Richmond is the host city, this is the United States World Championships. It only happens every 15 or 20 years. The World Championships only go outside of Europe once every 5 years. So this is not just us. This is a national event. We'll be seeking participation from sponsors and all kinds of contributions at a national level.
So is this going to be, is it road, track, is it the whole thing?
Yeah, this is road. This is the roads, not track and not cyclocross.
Okay.
But it's the big one. I mean, the road championships are the largest of the UCI championship series.
And is it all going to be within the state?
Yes.
Wow.
And it'll be centered on Richmond, and we have a finish line area that we've used for past races, and I imagine that'll probably be where the finish line is for many of the events, but they'll go out into the countryside. You don't have to go too far outside of Richmond to get into some very beautiful rural areas, so it's a nice city in that respect. There is some sprawl, but it's not totally surrounded by sprawl, and so you can get out into the countryside real fast.
So here's a question that didn't occur to me until just now. So part of what we have been reporting on in the last couple of weeks is about all of these wonderful racers who have now been stripped of titles, stripped of medals, stripped of jerseys, all of that. By 2015, what do you think the sport of cycling might look like in that regard?
Well, I'd like to think it will be totally clean and devoid of doping, et cetera. I don't think I'm quite that naive to think that it would be, but certainly there will be a very high level of scrutiny. I know that part of the process of running the race involves having the necessary testing available and independent testing agencies, et cetera. So there's already planning in place to put on whatever the best science testing supports at that time. That's what will be used, and we certainly aim to conduct a clean race. And it's something that it's constantly people come up with new methods, and then you have to come up with new tests, et cetera. I don't know whether that will ever expunge that from cycling, let alone any sport. People are always going to be looking for an advantage. We'll see if we can keep it clean, and that's our intent here in Richmond. And I like to think that maybe we're getting to the point where people don't see that it's really worth it, because cheaters never win, right? If someone wins the Tour de France, but then they're shown to have used some unfair advantage, well, they didn't really win. So it's a short-lived and a hollow victory.
Yeah, I agree. I just – it didn't occur to me until, realizing – I read it, 2015 Worlds. I'm going, wait a minute, this is way bigger than just typing it on a page. This is really a very cool thing that's happening there.
Well, we're telling people in Richmond, most people in Richmond have heard about it, but we still don't think that they really comprehend what we're talking about.
Right.
But we're talking about perhaps 500,000 people visiting Richmond over the space of 10 days. And economic impact studies have been done that indicate it could have an impact of well north of $100 million for just a little more than a week. So it's the largest event of its kind that's ever been held in Richmond, and we aim to make sure it's done right and make the most of it. And hopefully there will be a legacy in the form of increased awareness of cycling. Certainly Richmond's going to put its best foot forward, and we're doing a lot of things in Richmond already that are designed to enhance the cycling environment for commuters and just people who want to ride on a daily basis. And they're not really oriented towards racing, but we've raised the level of awareness of cycling in a number of ways, and the race is certainly one of them. So we think that that will have a good effect all around, and by the time 2015 rolls around, we want to be known as an international cycling city. And we already have so many assets that are built in for that we just haven't really identified or labeled in that way. For instance, we're starting to put sharrows down on some of the roads, and there are maybe 3 or 4 miles at most of sharrows right now in Richmond. We aim to have 80 miles of lanes and sharrows within about 2 years, and then there will be an expansion and more aggressive efforts to create a cycling-friendly infrastructure. But a lot of it is already there on the ground. It just needs to be marked appropriately.
How big is Richmond? What's the population?
Boy, you would ask me that. The greater Richmond area, I believe, has a population, the standard metropolitan statistical area, approaching 1 million. But the city proper is probably more on the order of 250,000. And I'm probably off on that, but... But
no, that's close enough. It's similar to the Cleveland area.
Yeah, it's a great city. We have wonderful cultural attractions. We've got a great ballet. We have an orchestra. We have a number of other things. Well, for instance, I wrote about in one of my articles. I wrote about the fact that we have Class 4 whitewater rapids in the downtown central business district, and we have an island in the middle of the James River.
Wow.
That's surrounded by those rapids, and all over that island are hiking trails and mountain bike trails. And on the other side of that island is a climbing wall. I mean, there's a lot of really neat outdoor-related assets that you just can't find anywhere, let alone all combined in one city. So it's pretty special. It's just that we haven't done a great job of blowing our horn, I think.
No, you haven't. Wasn't NABS there recently, the North American Handmade Bicycle Show?
Yes, that was fabulous.
Did you have fun?
Really,
I'll bet you went.
Loved it.
Yep, well, we're heading to Sacramento for it this year, so.
Yeah, that's a long way for me to go to see some beautiful bicycles.
Yeah.
So maybe they'll come back here sometime.
I would think so. So are you going to the Bike Summit?
I am.
All right. And
in fact, I'm toying with the idea of riding. It's about 100 miles, and haven't ridden that far in a long time, but I think I can still do it, and would like to do that just as, I guess, a sort of a statement that it's a practical thing to do.
Well, I would like to meet up with you and say hello in person. I will be there.
You'll be there?
I will indeed. I represent Ohio and my bike shop. And and I think that it's a very important thing that we do up there.
Oh, I agree. I went last year for the first time and just had such a great time meeting people and felt like I could make something of a difference and meet people who I could stay connected with. And it's great. Cycling is such a neat activity and yet it's not so huge that you can go there and you can meet people who are really prominent in, whether it's Andy Clark, the president of the League of American Bicyclists, or Earl Blumenauer, or Ray LaHood, it's a community that is very accessible and manageable in size, so that you can get the sense that you really do know people in it, and that you can work together as opposed to just some huge sea of maybe like-minded individuals, maybe not.
Well, it's fun. You walk up on Capitol Hill with your little neon bike pins, and they're
right.
Everywhere. They're everywhere.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
It is fun. Well, I hope to see you there, and I really appreciate you spending some time on the show with me this evening, and it's nice to get to know you outside of our little email exchanges. And we'll meet up in D.C. How's that? That's a deal.
That'll be great fun.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome.
Have a great evening.
You too.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Tom Bowden, cycling renaissance man from Richmond, Virginia.
Yeah, you think?
He joined us on the Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
He actually sent me another article he's been working on. I like his writing. It's very sharp. I like that kind of writing, you know.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Okay.
All right.
Let's take a short break.
We can do that.
We'll do a very quick spot of news. And when we come back, we're going to talk to somebody very interesting. I'm excited to hear this.
Okay.
All right. Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland. 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Well, WJCU's Radiothon 2012 is drawn to a close, and the entire staff would just like to thank you, our listeners, for all your generosity and support. With it, we'll keep growing through this year and into the next. Thank you.
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 Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and it's time to catch up on the news, because we've been in a news deficit the last couple of weeks.
So we will try and get back on the plus column here.
Okay.
Probably the most interesting news to come across my screen, especially if you're involved in bicycle advocacy, and we mentioned this last week, is the announcement that the League of American Bicyclists, Bikes Belong, and the Alliance for Biking and Walking are about to join forces to form one organization. This is my birthday present, according to Greg. The official announcement was made a week ago Wednesday after a three-day meeting in San Diego. Quite a few of the bicycling dignitaries attended the meeting and came away with two key dates on their timeline. One is September 2012 to make the decision whether to proceed with this concept, and the other is to launch the new organization by January of 2013. The goal is to speed progress in creating a bicycle-friendly America, where bicycling is a viable transportation and recreation choice for everyone and more people bike more often. This proposed unification would combine the significant resources of the three groups into one effective, powerful organization with a clear, integrated structure and a single voice. It only took 35 years, but I'm very excited, and I hope it happens, because I really think that that will make a huge difference, pooling all those the resources and the people and the funding, and maybe we'll see the Bike Council. You remember how there's Milk Council and the Pork Council and the Heard It on the Grapevine Grape Council? Well, what about a Bicycle Council? I love the idea. I'm so excited. Okay, we're moving on.
Could be the NBA, the National Bicycle Association.
Doesn't use a ball, does it?
No. Like the NRA, but
right.
The NBA.
Well, then there's
and
also...
We'll have Lance up there like Charlton Heston hoisting a bicycle above his head with one arm and, you know...
You think? No. I don't think so.
All right, move along.
We're moving on. So this is in the feel-good category from Velo News. And you sent me this, too. Everybody saw this. Centenarian claims the one-hour record. Okay, Robert Marchand is 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he rode 24.25 kilometers, or 15.1 miles, in 60 minutes, watched by crowds of cheering supporters at the International Cycling Union, the UCI Velodrome in Agde, Switzerland. The feat does not threaten the 49.7-kilometer 30.8 miles achieved by Czech cyclist Andrzej Sosenska in 2005 at the age of 29. But it will be recognized by the UCI in a new over 100 category. I'm not playing at being a champion, he said. I just wanted to do something for my 100th birthday. Come on now. I haven't cycled on a track for 80 years, he said. You have to get used to the fixed gear. I prefer cycling outside, but that is impossible at the moment, he complained as he watched the snow fall heavily outside the velodrome. I don't want to catch the flu, so I am short on training. I don't know how short he really is on training. Optimism aside, he knows his limits and remains cautious. For the last 5 years, I have decided not to go for rides of more than 100 kilometers. There is no point going overboard. I want to keep cycling for some time yet. That was my favorite quote of his.
Yeah.
Basically, he said, I'm like everybody. I am lucky that I haven't had any major health problems. My advice to anyone, young or old, is keep moving.
That's right.
I do physical culture every day. It works out my whole body and keeps me supple. Some people, when they reach 80 years old, start playing cards and they stay immobile. Not me. I've never been able to keep still, clearly, it was the last line from the writer. Isn't that a great story?
It is.
I want to be that. So my last one, and this is another one of those in my corner because I believe in this. Dr. Gabe, fitness and health. Fasting 2 days a week may benefit your brain. Aha. Researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine have collected evidence that reducing food intake to under 500 calories per day for 2 days a week may help prevent brain damage from Alzheimer's or Parkinson's diseases. Annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver, February of 2012. Fasting grows new nerves. It goes on. Skipping meals protects the brain. I am a believer in fasting. Now, if you're a cyclist and you have to have your 6,000 or 7,000 calories a day, I understand. This is tough. When you fast, you really need to be under the supervision of a doctor. That's what I recommend. But my longest fast was 7 days on just water.
Fasting doesn't extend your life, Diane. It only makes it seem longer.
I don't know about that, but that's an interesting coming from a cyclist, I understand that. But
food is one of the reasons we're here,
right.
I'm telling you.
Ride to eat. I know all about that. So that's my good news for this week.
All right. Now we're going to move on to kind of the centerpiece, as it were, of tonight's show.
Yes.
What we've all been waiting for.
Yes. It is my coup, my little feather in my cap. We are about ready to bring to you probably one of the coolest people on the planet, Graham Obrey, direct from Scotland. Good evening. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. It is such an honor to talk with you.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, I'm grand. Brand new. Been out riding in Scotland. Been some good weather for it.
How's Scotland today?
Scotland's good today. It's 5 degrees and it's not raining. So that's a good day in Scotland.
Hi, Ewan. So about 2 months ago, my partner Brian and I were watching The Flying Scotsman, your movie. And I had to talk to you. You became my new hero. So,
thanks very much.
Oh, I just fell in love with the movie. I fell in love with you. I think the whole thing is awesome. So you've been through a lot in getting to the philosophy you now have. Can we talk about your background just a little bit? Tell us where you came from and when you started riding. And you were actually born in England, but you think of yourself as Scottish. So when did you move to Scotland?
Well, I was about 6 months old or something like that, so I've lost my accent. And
yeah, you did.
My mother is Scottish anyhow, but they were there in England for work. So I am Scottish. I moved to Scotland, then lived here, lived in quite an isolated community in a valley. Not isolated like you, like United States, isolated like Nevada or something like that, but it was isolated and a very small community. And my father was a local policeman.
Aha.
And it didn't really fit into that community because, one, we were newcomers, and secondly, that my father was a policeman in the local community. So the childhood was a wee bit, a big bit, very isolationist, kind of lived in forests and then discovered cycling, and cycling's a great escape type sport, an exploration sport, and you can cycle everywhere, all over the place, as a vehicle of transport and freedom. A vehicle of freedom. A bike isn't a bicycle, an amazing thing. And then I joined the cycling club, and then people said, oh, you could be quite good at bike racing, and then I became a bike racer, and then I won bike races, and people started giving me money for winning bike races, and I thought, oh, let's do more of this. I was always a real cyclist because if I was fed up with bike racing, then I would go, oh, I'm not going to do any bike racing for the time being. And then I would put mud guards and and a pannier bags or a saddle bag on and still ride bikes. And I've got to say that I don't own a car. I've never owned a car. I've no intention of owning a car. I basically just cycle everywhere.
So did you ever take a long distance trip on the bike, like a touring trip?
Yes, I did. I went to Spain and France, and I've been to Italy and all over most of Europe. And I've been very, very, very lucky because of Old Faithful, and I went around most of the world.
Mm. Yeah, I know about Old Faithful. We're going to talk about Old Faithful. So when I saw the movie, I also saw that Francesco Mosier actually became a supporter and a friend of yours. Can you tell us a little bit of the story of your world record?
Well, actually, Francesco Mosier wasn't actually there in real life. The film is it's a dramatization of a very good story, but it's not a documentary.
Okay.
I didn't actually catch up with Francesco Mosier until after I won the World Championships in Italy. There's a big story to that as well. We were both at a big, huge track event live on Italian television, and I was stood next to Francesco live on television. I said, oh, borrow my bike. So, which he did, and it went wild, and then he said, yes, I will wild a bike like this and attack the world record, which he did. And then he put a sponge on it for his chest support, and then that helped me get banned by the World Cycling Federation.
Yeah, well, they're still doing crazy things today, don't you think?
Well, I think the sport needs regulated. Otherwise, African countries or poor countries can't afford the equipment to compete. Mm. But by the expense of cycling, it can't become an elitist sport where only rich Europeans or Americans can do it. So it has to be regulated to the point that bikes are affordable for everybody. So I think in a lot of ways they're right. And also, if you want no regulation cycling, what you have is what I'm actually attacking in September, which is the no rules human per vehicle record, which is 82.816 miles an hour on a flat road.
That's pretty fast, yes.
It is. That's a thought. I wouldn't like
sort
to
sort of a joke. That speed. That was a joke. But don't you think the UCI sort of goes overboard? I'm not saying it shouldn't regulate the sport, but, you know, they also have sort of some crazy rules. Well, look what you ran into with, you know, you kept having to change your bike and change your bike.
Well, I think what's happened is over the years, they've now got this set of rules which seem to be quite static at the moment. What they have done, though, I think, in terms of the hour record, is they've now changed their record that is actually harder to break in terms of technicalities. It's a more technical and involved and expensive endeavour to attack the world hour record now with a new format of, well, old format bike than what it was in the old days, where you can actually train on the road with tri-bars, turn up with your track bike on your position, follow the black line, and you need to go to the track once. Whereas nowadays you'd have to spend so much track time because of the need to strengthen the arms and the whole, you see, your arms become so much part of the hour record now that for me, I'm not interested in it because of that.
Really? So you would need a lot more upper body strength today?
Oh, absolutely. Because I actually came back for this about 3 years ago when I realised I was 40-something but still kicking out good power because I was racing with the British champion and he won two races and I won two races. And I thought, I'm mixing it with the British time trial champion, who is also mixing it with Bradley Wiggins and people of that calibre. So I thought, okay, let's have a go at this. Went to track for testing on a bike that was great on the road. And when I hit the bankings of the track, the whole geometry and physiology of it was totally different. And my whole upper body was aching within basically 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, the only way of doing this is spending weeks and weeks and weeks of track time I just didn't have. And the whole technicalities of it, it would need a real team endeavour to do this now. Whereas in the olden days, the old style, you have your tri-bars and it's not, the arms are taken out of the equation with tri-bars or whatever else. Then it's about physiology of aerobic and leg power, which is what cycling really should be about. It's about how fast you can actually pedal a bike. So the whole upper body thing became really, I didn't want to do it anymore because I never came to cycling to do an upper body sport.
Right, exactly. Otherwise you would be a weightlifter.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. Or a boxer or something else.
Sure, sure. So what have you, between the time you did all your world championships and your hour record, what have you done between then and now when you wrote this book, which I really, really like? We're going to talk a lot about your book.
Well, I've got to be honest and say I've gone one stage better than the royal family. I've actually taken a gap decade. My own troubles and depressions and things, which I've survived that and actually been stronger for it now, in a position to be more helpful to other people in terms of advice or anything else. And, well, in the meantime, there was the book, The Flying Scotsman, the book, and there was Flying Scotsman, the film.
Right.
And now I've written Aubrey Way, the training manual. And the next endeavour, there was really two endeavours in my calendar. The most important one, the number one endeavour, is tuning this engine back up again. That's like my body, tuning this engine that's going to power my land speed record vehicle, hopefully to go something approaching or possibly faster than the land speed record as it stands.
So where would you do this land speed record? At what location?
Well, the best place is stateside, and the World Championships for this is in Nevada, in a place called Battle Mountain. That is the middle of September, so the officials are there, the roads are there. It's probably the best road in the world for it. The timing strips there, all the other gangs that do land speed records are there. So there's a whole hubbub, everything. That is, at that moment in time of the whole year, that is the place to be if you're a human powered vehicle guy going for the world record. That's the place to be. So have to be ready, have to be there.
So is that going to be about the same time as our big bicycle show in Nevada, at Las Vegas?
I think it's going to be pretty close.
So we could maybe meet person to person. Wouldn't that be fun?
But maybe we can. Maybe you can come up to Battle Mountain and see my speed machine flying along that road, eh?
Do you know John Howard?
I've heard of John Howard, but I've never met him personally.
Yeah. So didn't he do the land speed record once? Didn't he break?
Well, he went behind. It was a fair, is a powered vehicle.
That's true.
And he sat behind it with a big, huge chain and did something like 150 miles an hour or something like that. It was an amazing thing. But this isn't like that. I think the land speed record itself is more pure because you don't have any variation of the quality of the vehicle or anything else. Basically, it is a straight road, a limited wind speed. Strict rules of wind speed. It's a flat road. There's no assistance of any kind. Wind speed, a flat road. How fast can you go on a bicycle? And the beauty of it is there's no rules and regulations apart from this vehicle must be human powered. That's it. No rules.
Who's building this new bike?
Well, I'm building this bike in my kitchen.
Attaboy. Of course you are.
Can I be honest about it?
Of course you can.
I mean, basically, I can actually get a whole lot more assistance from people in terms of the carbon, in terms of the absolute best ceramic bearings or whatever I can get. But you know what? I've had this bike designed in my head for the last 12 years. I was involved in a project in the 90s, and I realised I actually want to ride a prone position because I messed about with a prone bike in the 90s, and I found it so powerful and so much better design. I've got this design in my head. I've got the ability to build bikes, and I've still got some power in my engine, which I'm working on. And I'm thinking, you know what? Design the bike, build it, step up there with what you've got. You know what? You're either going to break the record or you're not, with just basically what you've got. And that's what I want to do, just step up there.
That's so cool. That's cool. I can't wait to see this bike. Let me tell you one thing about your book that I liked, and that is that you use big type so that people can actually read it.
I think the big type was almost, it wasn't deliberate to have the big type. I think it's that because of the format of the book, everything got bigger. It was kind of, that kind of went along with the format of the book. But this funny thing is, we didn't do this deliberately, but we now realised so many people have said, thank goodness that's big type, because I struggle to read normal type. We realised that most bikers are becoming, we're quite an old bunch getting, you know that? We're a bunch of oldies.
No, you're right.
It's like, that is right. And a lot of people have said, you know, thank goodness that's big type.
No, it's awesome. I loved it. The minute I opened the book, I went, this is cool. It's got big type. So you have.
So are you an oldie?
I'm not going to answer that question. Yes, I'm old. I'm older than you. I'm older than you are.
Oh, my goodness, that is, that does make you an oldie, by the way.
Oh, well, I'm way older than you. How's that?
Oh, that's definitely an oldie, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But then you might have, the ravage of time might have been kinder to you. That's the thing, see.
Oh, you look pretty good. You look just like you do in your book. I like all the pictures. Anyway.
All right. Well, I think some of the I wasn't so keen on a couple of the artworks of the drawing pictures of myself. They didn't look a wee bit
grandpa-y.
My son's laughing, looking at it like grandpa. I was saying to my manager, it was like, you're expecting some shelf life in this book. Look. nobody ever likes a picture of themselves.
No,
do they?
We don't. How old is your son?
He is.
I'll be 20.
20 next month.
Wow.
No, 20 in April, sorry.
Yeah, he's a young whippersnapper. So one of the things in your book that I liked was that you said, just training is bad for you, but training followed by rest and proper nutrition is good for you. And that you also say that training is a long-term process. I really like your attitude about training. How did you come up with that?
Well, my thought process was that a lot of people are new to the sport. And if you look at, if you just came to the sport today and you got all the cycling magazines and all the cycling books, you'd be completely confused about what to do.
True.
Because there's a whole lot of stuff just thrown at you. You've got to buy this, you've got to buy that. You'd just be a massive confusion. So I thought, you know what, just nail it exactly how it is. And also, people do think the more they train, then the better you're going to get. It's like training just as it's kind of the work ethic. It's like work harder and get more. But in fact, if you train better, that's a better thing to do. So I thought, nail that from the start. Because that is one of the mythologies of cycling that really holds people back.
So that you only train and then you have to recover and then you have to eat right. And then you can only train as much as you can train. You know, people have lives. And so you're saying that you can't train all the time, basically.
No, you can't. I mean, people have got partners, have got, some people get kids, have got jobs, have got social lives. And the thing is, I mean, most training schedules are really, really, really strict. You must do this at this X exact time. And life isn't like that.
Yeah, no,
it's
not.
You have to be able to roll with change and be adaptable. Most people have to get X number of hours free in a week to do some sort of training. You've got to be flexible in terms of making the best use of that.
Do you think people tend to overtrain?
There's a very strong tendency. And what happens is people overtrain. Then you think, I'm not really going as fast as I thought I would have done with all this training. Then you think, I better train harder. Then they do, and then they train harder, and then the form goes even worse, and then they think, obviously I'm not training hard enough to train even more. And I've actually known people being diagnosed as having exhaustion and malnutrition.
Yeah, I can believe that, sure. How did you come up with your breathing idea? Now, I'm a yoga teacher, so we do a lot of breathing.
All right, I'm glad you asked that. I was sat in a headland in the island of Arran, of a wee secret headland that I go to write my books. And I was reading a big, thick book about lung function and gas exchange. And I realised that the lung is actually a bellow with one entrance and one exit for the air to come in and out. Mm. And then I realised that because of the limitations of nature, we are mammals who have to breathe from the very first instance of birth, that the easiest way is actually for us to breathe in and out rhythmically. Otherwise, any species might not survive that does respiration. But there's two main factors to breathing that's important is how open can your lung be with the most amount of good air in it, and how high can oxygen content be within that lung. Bearing in mind that your lung, as you breathe in and out, you only breathe out one third of your air and breathe back in one third of the air, even when you're doing an aerobic effort. So that's mixed with bad air. So the oxygen content goes down to about 16% from an atmospheric normal of about 21%. So you've got less oxygen and your lung half the time is breathing it out, so not making most use of breathing, getting that oxygen into your body. So in a short, I formulated this process where you get the most amount of oxygenated air for the most amount of time, which increases the amount of oxygen uptake to the body.
Yeah, you have a sort of this breathing exercise that you explain how to breathe. I know we consider breathing out as important as breathing in. And I don't think most people breathe out enough air.
No, they don't. And it's part of our makeup as people, as animals, instinctively. Because breathing is an instinctive thing. But instinctively, the most important thing is to actually breathe in. Like if you saw somebody drowning, they would trying to gasp air in to an already full lung. So, but the most important thing they could do is actually breathe out and breathe a fresh bunch of air into their lungs, but they don't do that. If you're drowning, you try to keep breathing more air into an already full lung, which is actually, that's not good if you want to survive a drowning experience.
So, in addition to breathing, what do you consider good diet?
Well, our conscience knows what a good diet is. I mean, how often do you go to eat something and, well, no, I shouldn't, but I will anyway? I mean, the truth is, all of us, you kind of know what you should and shouldn't eat. Your grandma said, what you should and shouldn't eat. And you know what you should and shouldn't eat. So, I mean, you could lay out this big, huge diet and a book itself about what you should and shouldn't eat. When in fact, you kind of know what you should and shouldn't eat. So I'm saying, you know what, follow your conscience. Cut out the most amount of salt that you can, because salt is really, really debilitating in terms of how much of it we have in the modern diet, and so much salt added to food that we really, really don't need. And also, obviously, keep out the fatty products as well. So if you follow those two things and follow your conscience in terms of having vegetables and natural food, getting the vitamins from natural things, like just vegetables, basically, and good quality food, and avoiding the worst of what our conscience knows is bad food. For the average person that's going to parties or visiting friends and they've got cocktail nibbles, and you've kind of got to use your conscience most of the time. Very few of us can get up in the morning and say, I'm spending this whole day today being a professional cyclist and eating perfect food and training perfectly. We don't have that privilege. So most people have to make compromises, and it's how much close to that compromise that you get to. And you have to use your conscience and your decision-making process to say, okay, I'll eat that, but I won't eat that because, well, I'm making a decision of in my conscience.
So are you a vegetarian?
Actually, I'm not, but I'm kind of close to it because, well, it's a weird one. And in Scotland, we have what you call a saver shelf.
Yeah.
Like, let's say the store's going to close at 10 p.m., at, let's say, 9 p.m, all the food gets put down in price, and if it doesn't get sold, then it's going to get put into a landfill site.
Huh.
Now, if I see meat is going to get put in a landfill site, I'll buy that because that's not encouraging the meat industry, and it's not... That meat's going to get destroyed, so I might as well have it, but I wouldn't go and actually generally buy meat that encourages the meat industry, only in a moralistic point of view.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I do like eating meat. I mean, I like meat, and I think it's good for you. But if it's going to get thrown away, then that's the meat to buy. Don't go buying fresh meat. That means there's more meat industry than what there needs to be.
But just that, actually. But actually, we actually farm more meat than we should. We actually eat something like four times the amount of meat we actually should be eating. We actually overindulge in protein. The average person eats like something like 25 to like 100 grams of meat every 2 or 3 weeks.
Not every 2 weeks, but days. But you're kind of right.
Sorry. Kind of right in terms of a meat.
But Eunice, right, too much meat is actually bad for you in terms of cholesterol and everything else.
Yep, I heard it. We actually have him on. We have him on the show now. So Ewan, you're on the show now too. Yeah,
You're immortalized in the show.
Are you gonna do a book tour when you get here to the US?
Actually, I don't know. Oh no, I've closed it.
Oh no, it's still on.
What?
Not see something.
No,
am I still good?
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought I turned the computer off here. My thumb went on the button.
No. I got you. Are you thinking about a book tour? Are you going to stay long enough to do a book tour when you do your world record?
I don't know what I'm going to do. Generally, my manager, I just said to my manager, tell me what to do. I'm like one of those dolls you pull the string at the back and you kind of point in the direction of this. Like, tell me what to do.
What, are you
like
a puppet?
You've got to make a decision that way. Yeah.
You're the puppet, huh? They just pull your strings and you go where they tell you to go.
Well, I'm a puppet because I tell them it's okay to make me a puppet today.
Okay.
So I'm a kind of, it's a puppet but not a puppet because I'm telling them it's okay to let me be a puppet today.
self-rebelled, I'm in charge, I suppose.
All right.
It'd be great to catch up with real cyclists in America, though. I look forward to that.
That would be fun. So let's tell our listeners how they can get a copy of The Obrey Way. Where can they get a copy?
At the moment, you have to go to obrey.com. And all the details are on there. My manager's put up stuff on that obrey.com of how to get a hold of that book. And as time goes by, we're obviously wanting to make the book as accessible as it can be. But at the moment, it's available on obrey.com. And I can't really tell you much more than that because I'm just a puppet. I don't know.
We already established that, right? So, okay, obrey.com, OBREE.com. And we will indeed make sure that we have a link to that on our website. And I am so happy to have been able to talk to you today. I hope that I get to meet you when you come to the U.S. That would be so much fun.
Oh, absolutely. And we're looking forward to another great summer of cycling. Well, I certainly am.
Okay. Well, we'll get you a link so that you can hear our interview, and we'll tell you when it's going to be on the air. And we will talk soon again, I hope.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, and thanks for your interest. Look forward to meeting up with you.
Okay. Bye-bye, Graham.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, Ewan.
Bye.
Bye.
Graham Obrey joined us via Skype from his home in Scotland. I feel like that interview needed subtitles in a few places.
Well, and it was tough for me to understand some of the things he said. But once you kind of got the hang of the way he talked,
yes.
I got to understanding him. But I was wondering if you would have problems editing that and listening to it. You know what? Just play it again, Sam.
It was all worth it.
That's what podcasts are for.
That's
you
right.
can repeat it and keep playing it until you get it. Because
yeah.
I'll tell you what, he is adorable.
How
just
cool.
adorable.
And how cool is that?
And did you hear that? He's coming to the States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's he going to be
riding? He's going to be trying to break that land speed record in Nevada. It turns out it's the week before the Interbike. So I don't know if I'm going to be there that early. Although Brian thinks we should go to Dirt Demo this year, which starts on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
He says I should not have missed it last year. Because the show needed that information. I'm like, okay, then we'll go a couple weekdays early.
All right. That, you know, if you can go a couple days early, go 4 days early and see Graham Obrey.
Will do that.
Is he stopping by Interbike after
You know what? I don't know that. But I'm in contact
me.
With his publicist, Charlie, and he said he would keep me informed as to what the plans are.
All right. Superman himself.
Yep. And he did sign my book, by the way.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
Cool.
All right.
Well, that wraps up a pretty good show, you know.
You think?
Yeah, you know. be sure to come back, but, you know, this worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe I'm better off when I'm gone.
No, I wouldn't say that, but you're pretty good for not being here.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, even a blind squirrel, as they say. All right.
All right.
Let's get out of here.
March is marching on.
It is.
That means the season is right around the corner.
Oh, March 1st, psychological beginning of the cycling season for Diane.
Okay, there you
All
go.
Right.
All right. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.